Tuesday morning, April 18th, 1876. A carriage rattles through the streets of Balham, heading toward London. The wheels clatter over cobblestones. The springs creak with each rut on the road. Inside sit a husband and wife, 4 months married, already at war. Charles Bravo has said something. We don't know what. Perhaps another accusation about Dr. Gully. Perhaps another complaint about household expenses. Perhaps something about Mrs. Cox, the companion he once dismissed. Whatever it was, Florence has had enough.
Turn back.
Her voice carries the cold fury of a woman who's reached her limit.
I'm going home.
The driver hesitates. Charles reaches for her arm.
Florence, please.
She pulls away, her face turned toward the window. The gray London morning reflected in eyes that will not meet her husband's. The carriage stops. The horse stomps impatiently. The driver waits for instruction. Caught between a husband who pays and a wife who owns the money that pays. A decision hangs in the spring air. Seconds stretch into a silence heavier than the fog rolling off the Thames. Finally, Charles convinces her to continue. What he said, what promise he made, we'll never know. Florence relented. They rode on toward the city in silence. Two people trapped in a carriage, trapped in a marriage, trapped in a web of secrets neither could escape. By nightfall, Charles Bravo will be dying. Within 3 days, he'll be dead. And this morning's argument, this moment of fury in a rattling carriage, will be examined by coroners, lawyers, in newspapers across England. Every word dissected, every gesture analyzed, every silence interpreted. What were they fighting about? Money? Dr. Gully? The companion Florence refused to dismiss? We'll never know. Florence never said. Charles never told anyone. But something in that carriage broke. Something that couldn't be fixed. Hello, friend. Welcome back to Foul Play. Last episode, we met the players in this Victorian tragedy. Florence Bravo, wealthy widow, former mistress of the famous Dr. James Gully. A woman whose past was an open secret in London society. Charles Bravo, the barrister who married her, despite knowing her scandal. And Jane Cannon Cox, the companion who knew all of Florence's secrets. We learned that Charles had investigated Florence before proposing. He knew about Gully. He knew about the affair, the pregnancy. He married her anyway. And spent 4 months reminding her of sins he claimed to forgive. Today we follow Charles through his final hours, from that morning argument to the moment he drinks from his bedside water jug, and everything changes. This is the day Charles Bravo dies, not quickly, not cleanly, but in agony that will last 72 hours.
After the carriage argument, Charles continued alone to his chambers in London. He was a barrister, qualified at the bar, respectable, connected to wealth through marriage if not by his own fortune. His chambers were at Essex Court in the Temple, that ancient warren of legal offices where young barristers built their career one brief at a time. Charles was 30 years old. He had been called to the bar only recently. His practice was modest, his ambition was not. What occupied his mind that day, we cannot know. The quarrel with Florence, certainly. The endless tension of a marriage built on secrets and resentment. Perhaps he thought about money. He always thought about money. Florence's money. His control of Florence's money. The £40,000 that had made her worth marrying despite her scandal. The trial records tell us that Charles finished his work in the city by late afternoon. Rather than return directly to the priory, he decided to go riding. Exercise to clear his head, perhaps, a chance to escape the suffocating atmosphere of home. He rode in the park. The spring air carried the scent of new leaves, of horse sweat, of London's perpetual coal smoke. Other riders passed, gentlemen taking their exercise, ladies in their habits. What happened next felt like an omen. The horse bolted, without warning, without apparent cause. The animal beneath Charles surged forward in sudden terror. Charles lost his seat, lost control, felt the reins burning through his gloved hands as the horse tore through the park. For terrifying seconds, he was a passenger on a runaway animal. Trees blurred past, other riders scattered. His heart pounded as he clung to the horse's mane, certain he would be thrown, certain he would die here in the park with his skull cracked on the hard-packed earth. But he wasn't thrown. He wasn't injured. The horse exhausted itself, slowed, stopped. Charles sat trembling in the saddle, his hands shaking, his breath coming in ragged gasps. Witnesses said he returned to the priory between 6 and 7 that evening looking shaken. His face pale beneath the flush of exertion, his hands unsteady as he handed the reins to the groom. His valet, Frederick Rowe, drew him a long, hot bath. Charles soaked in the water, letting the heat unknot his muscles, calm his nerves, wash away the sweat of terror. By the time he emerged, he seemed restored, dressed for dinner, ready to face his wife and her companion, ready for what he couldn't have known would be his last meal.
The dining room at the Priory, shortly after 7:30. Gas lamps cast pools of warm light across white linen and polished silver. The fire crackled in the grate. April evenings still carried a chill. Outside, darkness has fallen over Balham. But inside, the Bravo household prepared for dinner, with all the ritual of Victorian respectability. 3 people sat at the table, Charles Bravo at the head, the master of the house, even if the house belonged to his wife. Florence, to his right, still recovering from illness, her face pale, her appetite poor. And Jane Cox, the companion Charles has threatened to dismiss. The cook had prepared a proper English dinner. The first course was whiting. A delicate white fish served with butter sauce. Then came the lamb, roasted pink, accompanied by spinach and potatoes. Charles requested eggs on toast as well. A simple dish, perhaps to settle a stomach still unsettled from the afternoon's fright. Charles ate well. Whatever tension existed in the household, it didn't affect his appetite. He consumed the fish, the lamb, the eggs. He reached for the wine repeatedly. The burgundy set in its decanter, catching the lamplight. Charles poured himself glass after glass. 3 glasses, certainly. Perhaps 4. Neither Florence nor Jane touched the wine. Florence claimed illness. Jane rarely drank. Try to imagine this meal. The clink of silver on china, the soft rustle of napkins, the crackle of the fire. And beneath it all, a silence thick enough to taste. The morning's argument still fresh. Florence pale from her recent illness, or perhaps from something else. Some knowledge, some plan. Jane knowing her position hung by a thread. Charles presiding at the head of the table he hadn't paid for, in the house he didn't own. What did they talk about? The weather? The servants? Did they discuss the argument in the carriage? No one recorded the conversation, but the tension must have been thick enough to cut. Three people who knew too much about each other. Three people with secrets. Three people who, in a few hours, would be divided forever. Dinner lasted approximately an hour. Then the three of them moved to the morning room, a smaller, more intimate space where families gathered after meals. They stayed there for about 30 minutes. Small talk, perhaps. Strained silences. The fire burning lower. The clock ticking toward catastrophe. Then Charles suggested Florence retire to bed. She had been unwell. She should rest. Florence agreed. Jane accompanied her upstairs. Charles remained in the morning room alone. It was approximately 9 o'clock. He had less than an hour to live as a healthy man.
Charles Bravo sat alone in the morning room until approximately 9:15. What he did during those 15 minutes, no one knows. Did he finish his wine? Did he stare into the dying fire? Did he think about his marriage, his future, his wife's past? Did he plan tomorrow's confrontation with Florence about Mrs. Cox? The servants had withdrawn to their quarters. Florence was in her room with Jane Cox.
Hello, friend. I need to tell you about a book that had me completely locked in. It's called Run on Red by Noel W. Eiley. Picture this. A dark, empty highway through the Idaho hills. No cell signal for miles. Two women realize the headlights behind them aren't going away. What starts as road rage turns into something far worse. A brutal, heart-pounding fight for survival that doesn't let up for a single page. Laura and Olivia can't outrun what's coming, so they have to fight back. And this book does what the best thrillers do. It takes an ordinary situation and makes you realize how fast it can go sideways. I burned through it. Every chapter drops you off a cliff. If you're into Freda McFadden or Karen Slaughter, this is your next read. Run on Red is now available as a deluxe special edition with gorgeous stenciled edges, as beautiful on the shelf as it is terrifying in your hands. Out February 24th. Grab it while you can.
The house settled into the quiet of an English evening, the creak of old timbers, the whisper of wind against windows. Then Charles rose and climbed the stairs to his bedroom. On the staircase he passed the housemaid, Mary Ann Keeber. She was carrying a bottle of sherry and a glass to Florence's room, a nightcap for her mistress. Mary Ann would later tell police something odd. Charles looked at her twice as they passed. He didn't speak. He didn't nod. He just looked at her, pale, silent, strange. His eyes seemed to study her face as if searching for something. She thought nothing of it at the time. Gentlemen didn't always acknowledge servants. Perhaps he was tired. But she remembered that look. When the doctors came, when the police came, when the lawyers came, Mary Ann Keeber remembered that Charles Bravo had looked at her strangely on the stairs. Charles entered his bedroom. He closed the door. He undressed, removing his dinner clothes, hanging his jacket. He put on his nightshirt, white cotton, respectable. On his nightstand sat a glass jug of cold water. The servants prepared it fresh every evening, standard practice in any Victorian household. The water was clear, cool, innocent-looking. Charles reached for the jug. He poured himself a glass. He drank. Just a sip, perhaps two. What Charles Bravo couldn't have known, what no one knew until the post-mortem, was that the water contained enough antimony to kill 10 men. 30 to 40 grains of tartar emetic, a white powder, tasteless in water, odourless, invisible, commonly available at any chemist shop, used in medicine, used in stables to treat horses, used, apparently, to commit murder. The poison dissolved in Charles Bravo's stomach. It entered his bloodstream. It began to destroy him from within. He had minutes, perhaps less.
The bedroom door flies open. Charles Bravo staggers onto the landing. His face is white, not pale, but white, drained of all blood. His hands clutch his stomach. Sweat beads on his forehead, running down his temples. His mouth opens in a scream that echoes through the priory.
Florence! Florence! Hot water!
Marianne Kieber hears it first. She had just delivered the sherry to Florence's room. She runs toward the sound, toward a man in agony, a man doubled over on the landing. She finds Charles vomiting violently. His body convulses with each heave. Whatever is inside him, his system is desperately trying to expel it. The vomit spatters the polished floorboards, stains his white nightshirt, carries a strange, greenish tinge. She races to wake Florence, knocks on the door, pounds on it. Florence emerges, groggy from wine and illness. She wears her nightdress, her hair loose. Then she sees her husband, collapsed on the landing, retching, crying out.
Send for the doctor. Send for everyone.
Jane Cox appears. She had been in her own room. Now she takes charge, or appears to. She helps Charles back into his bedroom. She holds the basin while he vomits. She issues orders to the servants. A servant is dispatched to fetch Dr. Moore from Balham. Another runs to summon Dr. Harrison from Streatham Hill. The cook is roused to heat water. The valet hovers uselessly, watching his master suffer. By 10:30, Dr. Moore arrives. He finds Charles Bravo unconscious, collapsed on his bed, his skin clammy, his pulse weak and racing. Classic signs of poisoning. But poisoning with what? Moore examines the patient. He is baffled. The symptoms suggest poison, but the pattern doesn't match anything he recognizes. Not arsenic, not laudanum. Dr. Harrison arrives shortly after. Two physicians now stand over Charles Bravo, watching him die, unable to determine what is killing him. Charles regains consciousness briefly. His eyes fluttered open. His mouth forms words. The doctors need information. They need to save his life.
Mr. Bravo, have you taken anything, any medicine, any substance?
Charles's answer will echo through two inquests.
I rubbed some laudanum on my gums for a toothache, nothing else.
Laudanum, a tincture of opium. Common Victorian remedy. But laudanum doesn't cause these symptoms. Laudanum brings drowsiness, not violent purging.
Are you certain, Mr. Bravo? Have you taken anything else?
Nothing. I swear it. Nothing.
The doctors worked through the night. Stomach pumps, emetics to induce more vomiting, cold compresses, warm blankets, everything Victorian medicine could offer. None of it helped. More physicians were summoned as the night wore on, By Wednesday morning, Charles Bravo's bedroom had become a medical consultation room. Five doctors eventually attended him, including Sir William Gull, the same doctor who treated Queen Victoria herself. Sir William was 68 years old at the height of his reputation. His verdict was grim. This was antimony poisoning. The symptoms were unmistakable. The violent vomiting, the internal burning, the distinctive greenish colour of what Charles expelled. But Charles continued to deny taking anything. And here's what makes the case so maddening. He was lucid. For much of those 3 days of dying, Charles Bravo was conscious, coherent, capable of speech. The antimony was destroying his organs, but his mind remained clear. The doctors begged him to tell the truth. His stepfather, Joseph Bravo, wept at his bedside. His mother, Mary Bravo, pleaded with her only son.
Charles, please, if someone did this to you, tell us who.
Charles said nothing useful. He maintained his story about the laudanum. He denied taking any other substance. The night wore on, then another day, then another night, Charles slipping in and out of consciousness, his body failing, his organs shutting down. Jane Cox remained at his bedside much of the time. She held his hand. She wiped his brow. She would later testify that Charles had whispered something to her during those dark hours. A confession of sorts. Words spoken when no one else could hear.
I took some of that poison,
she said he told her.
Don't tell Florence.
5 words that would change everything, or nothing at all. But Marianne Keeber was in the room when this supposed confession occurred. She heard nothing. The housemaid, standing just feet away, heard no whispered words, no confession. The dying man said nothing. At least, nothing anyone else could verify. Only Mrs. Cox, alone among all the witnesses, claimed to hear Charles take responsibility for his own death.
By Wednesday evening, everyone who mattered had gathered at the Priory. Charles's parents sat in the drawing room, unable to watch, but unable to leave. Florence drifted between her room and his, pale as a ghost. Miss Cox remained at the bedside. The servants whispered in the kitchen. They watched Charles Bravo suffer. They watched him slip in and out of consciousness. They listened to his groans, his cries, his desperate pleas for water that would only make the burning worse. Who did this? The obvious suspect was Florence. Trapped in an unhappy marriage. Inheriting everything if Charles died. Free to return to Dr. Gully. Or simply, free. But she had been ill herself. Barely able to leave her bed. Then there was Dr. Gully. Still living in Balham. Still in love with Florence, still humiliated by her marriage to another man. He knew about antimony. He knew exactly how to kill with it. And Jane Cox, the companion Charles had threatened to dismiss, the woman who stood to lose everything if Charles had his way. She was the last person to see Charles before his collapse. She was the one who claimed he confessed. She had access to the antimony in the stables. But here's what haunts me. Charles Bravo had 3 days of agony. 3 days of lucidity. 3 days when he could have named his poisoner. Could have whispered a name. Pointed a finger. Written something down. He said nothing. Was he protecting someone? Was he punishing them with his silence? Or did he genuinely not know who had poisoned him? What do you think? Next time on Foul Play, Charles Bravo's final hours. The deathbed confessions that may or may not have happened. And the first inquest satisfied no one. Until next time, good night, friend.